to get going, I just wanted you to be aware that sometimes remarkable coincidences do happen in astrophysics. And there's this catalog of Herberg-Harrell objects. I won't explain exactly what that means, but it's a catalog of unusual objects that exist in our galaxy, and they assign each one a number. And this gentleman, actually it's three astrophysicists, wrote a paper on one of these objects, and it just happens to have the number 666, okay? So this is HH666, and the title of the paper is The Axis of Evil in the Carina Nebula. So also shows you these guys have got a sense of humor. But actually, there's a serious point here. 666 happens to reside in the Carina Nebula, which is considered the most violent nebula in our entire galaxy. There's no more place that's more violent than the Carina Nebula. And this particular object, 666, is kind of in the very nexus of these three axes of extremely violent gaseous jet behavior, hence the title of the paper, The Axis of Evil. And, you know, just to give you, and these guys have got away with words, too. It says, this inferno is scorched by the unforgiving ultraviolet radiation from several of the hottest and most massive stars known in our galaxy. 666 is condemned to toil in the inferno of the Carina Nebula, scorched by this ultraviolet radiation. So, but the whole point that makes this interesting from a Christian perspective is that astrophysicists are becoming increasingly aware that that was like the birthplace of our solar system. And because we were born in a place of such extreme violence, we happen to be enriched with just the elements we need for advanced life. You can find other places in the galaxy where you have the elements that are necessary for primitive life, but what's really unusual is the planet Earth is so rich in the elements that are critical for advanced life, and that really does require an incredibly violent birthing arena, just like this 666. So maybe we should refer to the solar system as 777. I don't know. But and I'm positive these guys really don't realize the significance of the number they assigned to this. But let me say for the last 15 minutes, this set of discoveries that really is quite remarkable, really new advances taking place in astrophysics that significantly advances the evidence for a Christian worldview interpretation. Now, what we're doing here in the class, for those of you that are new, is going through the 20 major creation accounts that we find in the Bible. And we're on, I don't know, what is it, number 6 or 7, Job 34 to 41. And right now we're looking at Job 38. And Job 38 is interesting, and it's the first of three of the major creation accounts that parallels Genesis chapter 1. So the very first creation account, Genesis 1, gives a sequence of physical creation miracles that God performs to prepare the planet for human beings. But to help us understand the scientific content of Genesis chapter 1, we have three other creation passages in the Bible that reflect on what's going on there. But these three additional passages are all poetic passages. You know, some have argued that Genesis 1 is itself poetry, but there's plenty of evidence, and we reviewed this when we were going through the first chapter of Genesis, that it indeed is prose. It's not poetry, it's prose. But it's such beautiful prose that sometimes people think it is indeed poetry. But Job 38 is indeed poetry. And the three creation passages that reflect on Genesis 1 are all poetry. The two others are Psalm 104 and Proverbs 8. And as I mentioned, you know, 2 weeks ago as we were getting through this, the difficulty with poetry is it doesn't have the strict chronology that prose does. I mean, as you go through Genesis chapter 1, we have the confidence, because of the way it's laid out with the six creation days, that creation miracle number 1 predates creation miracle number 2, which predates creation miracle number 3. You read down the page, and that indeed is the historical sequence of events. That doesn't usually work with poetry. Poetry will jump around. And so one of the things I've done for you is to go through Job 38 and pick out the parallel verses that reflect back on the six creation days in Genesis 1. And just to give you an example, what I'm going to actually do here is we'll read what it says in Genesis chapter 1 on the first creation day, and then look at Job 38, and we'll read the parallel passages that pertain to creation day one. Then we'll go through day two, three, four, five, and six. But for example, for creation day one, we see parallel comment in Job 38 in verses 4 to 9, 12 to 14, and 19 to 21. So it's picked up three different places. Now, the problem with many English readers is we're not used to the Hebrew poetic style, and therefore we might pick up the first one and we miss the other two. And that's what's really happening here in Job 38. It's going through these six creation days, but it jumps around and it overlaps. After all, it's set up as poetry, so poetry does lend itself to that kind of complexity. But let me just give you an example of how this works, and we'll see how many of these creation days that we can get through in Job 38. Okay, Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to actually start with first three verses, so we'll begin with the two verses that predate the first creation day. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Verse 3, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Okay, now let's go to Job 38. And you know, what's happening here in Job 38 is God's accomplishing several purposes. You know, Genesis chapter 1 was basically trying to give the reader the physical creation miracles that God performed to prepare the way for human beings. But Job 38's got multiple purposes, and that's one of the things you can do with poetry. You can, get several birds with the same stone. And, the Lord speaks here, and he's addressing these five men. And he's basically going to put them to the test. He asked them questions about creation. And so he's ministering to these five people by the questions he's asking. He's also ministering to future generations. I mean, what I want us to do as we go through the Lord's message to these five men is realize he's not just speaking to the five, he's speaking to the entire human race. I believe that he's speaking to the most brilliant scientists alive today. I mean, as you get into Job 39, for example, he brings up a new theme. And he says, you men think you understand so well the biology of this planet. But all you can really claim to understand is the physical aspects of biology, and even there you don't do very well. But what kind of comprehension do you have about the soulish characteristics of the animals that I've created? And you know, when you read through Job 39, we are no wiser than the five that were listening to the Lord 3,500 to 4,000 years ago. We're no better off. Our comprehension's no deeper than their comprehension in terms of coming up for scientific answers for the soulish characteristics of the birds and mammals and human beings. But God is actually using that same approach in Job 38. He's asking questions and says, you know, you men think you're so smart, so clever, or figured so many things out. I got some questions to pose to you. And what he's basically doing is trying to engender the humility that they need to really respond to the gospel message that God's built into the creation. And as you go back previous to Job 38, you've got both Job and Elihu explaining the basic elements of God's plan of salvation by looking at what God has revealed in the record of nature. But it takes humility to comprehend that message, and very few of us can claim to have the humility of either Job or Elihu. But the Lord here is speaking, trying to engender that humility, not only in Job's three friends, but literally us today that are listening to him. But all the while he's doing that, he's reflecting on the events in Genesis 1. So that's what we're going to do, is go through these events of Genesis 1, and then we'll pick up the larger context of what God's trying to do in ministering to the five and in ministering to us. And that's what's remarkable about this creation text in Job, is it's got a creation message that literally spans 35-plus centuries of human history and ministers to us all over that time. But creation day one, okay, picking it up in verse 4, he says, where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? And that reflects right back to Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Tell me if you understand, who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? You know, when I read that, I kind of reflect back to Stephen Hawking's boast in A Brief History of Time. the world's best-selling science book of all time. I heard it's now over 10 million sold copies. So, but you know, what he mentions in that book is how his lifelong goal is to come up with the equations of physics that will give him understanding for the foundations of the universe. Now, there's good reason to demonstrate that that's an impossible goal. And this is what the Lord is addressing here, saying, you know, you think you can't even get the basics figured out. Forget about trying to understand the biology or the chemistry. You can't even comprehend the basic physics, the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Do you even understand the dimensions that govern the universe? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? You know, this is the only creation account we're going to find in the Bible outside of Hebrews chapter 11 that mentions angels. This is the only one. You can go to Hebrews 11, but this one talks about how the angels were witnesses to God laying the foundations of the earth and marking it out, and they were singing for joy. In other words, what God was doing was so utterly amazing and impressive to them that it had this kind of impact on them as they watched this taking place. You know, and this is the only place in the Bible you can go to answer the question, when did God create the angels? And there's only one verse, Job 38:7, that gives you any inkling as to when God created the angels. Hebrews 11 won't tell you that. It just tells you what they're doing now. But this tells us that the angels were present when God was laying the foundations of the earth. So that means the angels have been around for 4.57 billion years, maybe longer. But they've been around at least that long. However, this passage does not address the question, as some have suggested, as to when Satan fell. This text doesn't tell us that. It simply tells us that the angels were present when God was laying the foundations of the earth, and that they were very impressed with what he did. And the point that God is making here, if the angels are impressed, we should be impressed. I mean, surely they know more about what's going on there than we do, and yet they were very impressed by what they observed here. Now, it moves on. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it? Now, what we see here is that this passage from verse 8 and following really is addressing three creation days. Creation day 1, creation day 2, creation day 3, all wrapped up into one. You say, where's creation day 1 in this? Well, it's in the ninth verse where he says, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. Now, if you go back to Genesis 1:2, what it talks about there is a passage that's been quite controversial in the Christian community. And indeed, it's something I had to address in this book, A Matter of Days. You know, people who take a young earth perspective, really read Genesis 1:2 and believe that this is really talking about when God first creates light, period. Whereas I've suggested that the correct interpretation to take is that God created light in the beginning, but there was no light on the surface of the waters of planet Earth because the cloud layer and the debris cloud that existed in the primordial solar system would not permit the passage of sunlight or starlight to the surface of the Earth. And when you read it in Genesis 1:2, it's not totally clear, and I would argue there's room for debate on what this is saying in Genesis 1:2. And that's really probably one of the more hostile aspects of the debate on the interpretation of the creation days in Genesis 1. But look how beautifully Job 38 addresses that issue. Okay, in Genesis 1:2, now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Some interpret that darkness as pervading the entire universe. You know, I take the position it's referring to the surface of the waters of planet Earth. When you go here to the ninth verse of Job 38, he says, who shut up the sea behind the doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? So it's making direct reference to the fact that the clouds were like a thick blanket that God had wrapped around the earth and kept it enshrouded in darkness. Therefore, no need for a lot of hostility that's permeating the church today over what's going on Creation Day 1. And if you look more carefully in Creation Day 1, the text does not say that God created light on Creation Day 1. It says, let there be light, which means that God took the blanket away. And now the light that he created in the beginning is able to pass through to the surface of the waters. As we mentioned in our book on Origins of Life, what it also tells us in Genesis 1:2, the Spirit of God is brooding over the surface of the waters. And the word that's used there in the Hebrew is used one other time. You'll find in the book of Deuteronomy where it refers to a female eagle who's brooding above her eggs at the point that the eggs are about to crack open and the little eaglets are about to come out. And so the suggestion we make in the Origins of Life book is that the Bible actually identifies the timing of the origin of life as Creation Day 1. This is when life first appears. And, you know, as I've been mentioning here in the class, we now have substantive scientific evidence from carbon-12 to carbon-13 analysis, and very interestingly, from uranium oxides, that proved that photosynthetic life was there at the base of the tree of life. The origin of life 3.8 billion years ago, much of that life was photosynthetic. And given that it's photosynthetic, it needs light coming through that cloud layer. God took away the blanket of darkness so that the light could come through so that photosynthetic life could flourish. And it's really critical in terms of having human beings on planet Earth today that you get the photosynthetic life going really quickly, as soon as it's possible, physically possible for life. You want photosynthetic life on planet Earth. Why? Because our planet is loaded with gigantic oxygen sinks. And here you have all this photosynthetic life on planet Earth. And it wasn't for the oxygen sinks that photosynthetic life could put enough oxygen into Earth's atmosphere to support human beings in less than a million years. Wouldn't have to take 3.8 billion years, but it did take 3.8 billion years because you can't get that oxygen into the atmosphere until you first fill up the oxygen sink, for example, that exists in the mantle. You know, most of the Earth, in terms of its volume mass, is the mantle. You got this core, you got the crust, but the biggest part of all is the interior mantle. And until that is fully oxygenated, you're not going to have oxygen accumulating in the Earth's atmosphere. That's one of several oxygen sinks that have to be filled. So again, I think from a scientific perspective, Job 38 and Genesis 1, this really does lend credibility to the interpretation, namely that the Earth had this atmosphere that was opaque to light, and then God transformed that atmosphere so that light could pass through, we could have photosynthetic life, and now we're on the way to preparing the planet for human beings. There's a, yeah. Okay, by day one for sure, and this is something that all Christians agree on, there's no dispute on this, by creation day one, the earth is in place. Now there's debate over what form the earth was in, but the earth certainly existed. If the earth existed, the sun must have existed. And so the sun was there before creation day one. Now, that gets into another issue of controversy and get to the creation day four, but we'll save that for the moment, okay? But yeah, the sun and the stars were present. So there was light in the heavens. In fact, there would be light in the heavens by the time the universe is a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. By then, you've got photons existing in the universe. And then stars would come somewhat after that time. Yeah, the sun doesn't start burning until 4.5 billion years ago. Okay. No, it would be before day one. I'll give you a quick history of the sun. And by the way, you'll also find this in the last chapter of the Origins of Life book. So I give a little summary there. And actually, I'm going to be doing an entire book on the history of the sun. That'll be coming out in a couple of years' time. But you're right in the sense that when the sun is forming, it's doesn't have nuclear burning taking place. Nevertheless, it does shine with light. because as the cloud that is collapsing that will form the future solar system, the collapse of that cloud by itself will generate light. It's gravitational collapse. And when you collapse something gravitationally, you heat it up. And so there's quite a bit of light coming out of the sun even before it ignites nuclear burning. However, that phase of collapse, the light that's coming out from the sun is extremely variable. For the first 50 million years of its history, the luminosity of the sun is going up and down by very dramatic amounts. You say, how dramatic? Well, by about a factor of four. So you get up tomorrow, and the sun's four times brighter than it is today. And you get up the next day, and it's four or five times dimmer. Not a very good situation for life. I mean, it goes from different parts of the spectrum. This little thing I was referring to you about HH666 and the axis of evil, well, that's kind of what's going on with the sun when it's really young. It's in this incredibly violent stage of its history, and its light is going up and down by at least a factor of four. Now, it's probably more dramatic than that given where the sun was born. However, if you want to just go out tonight, well, probably can't. Well, if you have to get, well, I think Orion's down now. Yeah, it is down. You got to get up early in the morning. So if you get up early in the morning, get out your pair of binoculars and look at the bright stars in the Orion Nebula. And if you do that several days on end, you'll see that the light goes up and down. In fact, I did that as a high school science project. I spent a couple of years actually looking at the variability of those stars in the Orion Nebula. And it's literally something you can do with a good pair of binoculars. I had a small telescope so I could get some of the others. But you can see this very dramatic change in brightness over the course of several months. And that's what happens with all newborn stars. Even the most stable of newborn stars are going to go through that. Okay, that's for the first 50 million years. The next 500 million years, the sun is more stable and it's burning. However, during that period, it's losing mass. And so as the sun loses mass, it gets dimmer and dimmer. So for about the first billion to billion and a half years of its history, the sun is losing brightness. And that's because, you know, the sun doesn't lose that much mass. It loses between 4% and 7% of its total mass during the first billion years of its history. However, the brightness of the star goes up with a fourth power of its brightness. Fourth power. Well, it's actually 3.9, but that's doesn't make much difference. And so what happens is the sun actually loses one-fifth of its brightness during this stage. It would lose more than one-fifth, except that during that 500 million years, the sun finally does ignite nuclear fusion. So now it's got a fusion furnace going on in its core. And that fusion furnace is converting hydrogen into helium. But helium is a catalyst. The more helium you got in the core of the star, the faster it causes hydrogen to fuse into helium. So the net result is the sun gets brighter and brighter. But during the first billion to billion and a half years of its history, it's losing mass at a fast enough rate that it's actually getting dimmer more than it is getting brighter. But the net result is it gets about 20% dimmer than it is today as a result of that mass loss, and then it stops losing mass. The sun actually is losing mass today, but it's losing mass at an incredibly tiny rate, and so it's essentially, that doesn't make a difference. So when it's about that age, it stops losing mass at a fast rate, and from that point onward, the sun gets brighter and brighter. So the sun today, I mean, it lost 18% of its brightness, and now it's picked up that 18%, and the future of the sun is that it will continue to get brighter and brighter. Yeah, the burning, as you get more and more helium produced, it's going to get brighter and brighter and brighter. Well, we do, but let me just finish the story here. The next 500 million years, so the first 50 million years, it's not a very good situation for life. The brightness is going up and down like crazy. The next 500 million years, it's getting dimmer and dimmer, but at a slow rate, you know, so it's much more stable. However, during that episode, it's pouring out X-ray radiation at about 100 times the rate that we have today. And therefore, you ask the question, how come God doesn't create life until the Earth is about 700 million years old. Well, there's a good reason why it doesn't create life during those first 700 million years. Too many X-rays coming out. And there are a couple of life forms that can handle that degree of X-rays, but they don't do much. They're very slow metabolizing life forms. So 3.8 billion really is the first moment that God can create life. That's just one reason. There are other reasons you'll see in the Origins of Life book why it can't happen earlier than that. But that kind of fits what we see here in Genesis 1, 3. You know, God transforms the atmosphere and does that just as the sun has finally subsided and its X-ray radiation, so that life is possible. Everything's beautifully timed. The earth is prepared for the entry of life at this very same time that the sun, for the first time in its history, has a radiation profile that would make life possible. They both coincide. That's one of the evidences we use in the book for why this has got to be the hand of God and not just an accident, because you've got two coincidences lining up. Exactly. Hand back there. Okay. The sun, first off, starts off pouring out energy through gravitational collapse. That great gravitational collapse eventually pushes the temperature at the core to where you get fission. Now, fission is things like uranium and thorium being split apart and a release of energy from that. But what that does is it drives the temperature of the sun up to where fusion is ignited. By the way, that's how we make H-bombs. You make an H-bomb with an A-bomb. You get a little tiny A-bomb. What that does is push the temperature up high enough that ignites the fusion bomb. While the sun... And you want to know how that was all figured out? 1938, a guy by the name of Hans Bethe looked at the sun, worked out the physics of the sun, then went to the physicists at Los Alamos and said, this is how you build an H-bomb. So the H-bomb really was born out of the work of the astrophysicist Hans Bethe in his study of the sun. But eventually the fusion gets ignited. And you're right, that generates an enormous explosion in the center of the sun. But that explosion is contained by the gravity of the sun. The sun is, you know, so massive that it's able to contain that explosion. And so we get this steady bathe of a bath of light from the nuclear bomb that's continuously exploding in the center of the sun. And that's still going on to today. Whereas the problem with making an H-bomb on the surface of the Earth is we can't contain it. And, you know, the whole thing burns till it runs out of fuel. That's true. Yeah, the primordial Earth would have all these unoxidized metals. And the oxygen rather violently reacts with these metals, and that all has to take place before you're going to get free oxygen in the atmosphere. In fact, most scientists believe that if they find large quantities of free oxygen in any planet outside of our solar system, that will be a signature for photosynthetic life, because there's really no other way to get a large quantity of a free oxygen except through photosynthetic life. Right. Okay, yes. Right. Yeah, there's actually a couple of things, several things that you could fit into how did God transform the atmosphere from an opaque condition to a translucent condition. You're right. The thing that would have the biggest effect would be this Mars-sized planet colliding with the Earth, because what that would do is strip the Earth of its original atmosphere and permit a much thinner one to replace it, one about 100 times thinner. And that's really good for life, because if we had been stuck with our primordial atmosphere, there would have never been life on planet Earth. So that's what's really exceptional about planet Earth. It's a big, rocky planet with a very thin atmosphere, very thin compared to what you'd expect from the physics of accretion. But the Mars-sized collider, and by the way, the date for that collision was about when the Earth was 50 to 60 million years old. That's when the collision took place. That was really early. However, there is another big collision event just before the origin of life, and that's called the Late Heavy Bombardment. And I think I mentioned here in the class that there's a new study that shows that the Late Heavy Bombardment was much more intense than what physicists thought just a year ago. Intense enough that it would have liquefied the surface of the Earth about 600 kilometers deep. And this, too, would have had an impact on helping to transform the atmosphere, because the atmospherics of that collision would have been quite dramatic. So, and then the fact that God starts creating light, that begins to change the chemistry of the atmosphere as well. And so over time, we have the light being able to penetrate. And also the background to all of this, the debris in the inner solar system is gradually being dissipated just by the normal gravitational history of the inner solar system. You know, before 3.8 billion years ago, the inner solar system had significant interplanetary debris. But by the origin of life, that debris had subsided very considerably. So that also would help the penetration of sunlight to the surface of the Earth. Yeah. I'd say the Mars-sized collider had the biggest contribution to this transformation of the atmosphere. But there's at least two other events that factor into that as well. It's not instantaneous. No, this is something that's taking place over time. And that's something that neither Genesis 1 or Job 38 addresses, how much time it took God to take this blanket of darkness away from the surface of the water. Just as he did it. Doesn't tell us how, and doesn't tell us over what time period, although I would argue that according to Genesis 1:3 and Job 38, verse 9, this is early in the history of the Earth rather than late in the history of the Earth. And according to Genesis 1, this would be an event that would be tied into the origin of life. So the clearing of the atmosphere is critical for the origin of life. Okay, let's see if we can move on. I thought we were going to get through about four or five creation days. Okay, that's verses 4 to 9. But you know, we're making progress. I mean, I kid you not, one of the most controversial debates on creation in the Christian church is over whether or not God created light on creation day one, or whether he transformed the atmosphere from opaque to translucent, and now we've got that resolved. This is huge progress. We can move on. That will take care of about a third of the fights that take place in the church on creation, so this is good news. And we can get things resolved. But this isn't the only place that addresses creation day one. If you drop down to verse 12, it says, "Have you ever given orders to the morning, or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment." And so with verse 12, you really have no doubt, because this is the same kind of language you see in the Genesis 1, verses 3 and 4, about how this is the first time that observers on the surface of the earth would recognize morning and evening, darkness and light. And so God poses this question, you know, do you understand how I pulled that off? And clearly they don't, and even today we really don't. Now, where there's some debate is when you get down to verse 14, the earth takes shape like clay under a seal. If you read several commentaries in the book of Job, they'll try to claim that this is a reference to the fact that God is telling these five men about the rotation of the earth. And the picture here is that, you know, in the old days when you wanted to seal something, you had this little lump of clay, and the king would come with a signet seal and he would press into it. But there were several of these seals where you press into it and you would rotate it a full 360 degrees. Therefore, you'll find in a number of commentators in the book of Job that this is God actually talking about the earth's rotation in the context of creation day one. Now, having read those commentators, I'd say possible, but I don't think it's a slam dunk. Because I was looking and saying, okay, where else in the Bible could you go to support this claim that Job 38 is actually a reference to the rotation of the earth? Maybe you can find one, but I couldn't find one. And so given that this is the only verse you've got that would support this claim, and given that it is a metaphor, and you know, what does the metaphor really mean? And it's quite possible that it is indeed a reference to the rotation of the Earth, but I'd be reluctant to try to use this as an argument with an atheist physicist, for example. You'd really have to find some support that this is indeed the metaphor that is suggested here in verse 14, or claimed in verse 14. No doubt that it's a metaphor. You know, the shape like clay under a seal. Clearly that's a metaphor, but I'm not saying it's beyond debate exactly what that metaphor means. Yes. Okay. There are certain seals that the kings and kings' officials use, where the pattern of the seal did not become evident unless you took this ring and actually rotated it through 360 degrees. So it probably has several dots lined up or a slash lined up, and when you do it, you get the particular shape. And the whole point there is the person getting that letter or that set of commands would know it was official because it actually had been pressed in and rotated all 360 degrees. So it means that the king actually paid some attention to what he was doing. It wasn't just an accidental hitting of the seal or this clay thing that happened to be hit by a thorn as the messenger was running around. This is your proof that this indeed was the purposeful intent of the king or the king's official. Or concentric something. Right. Yeah, you get it. Yeah, you get concentric circles of different depths and different thicknesses. And they were done in some way that you would get thin and then thick beside it. And it's clay, so some could be made deeper grooves than other grooves. And it was all done in such a way you could say, aha, that is the king's signet ring that was done there. It was an interesting idea, could be right. But I'd be a little bit cautious in trying to say that this definitely proves that the earth indeed, or God is claiming here that to these five men, that the earth is a rotating body. However, no doubt he's making references to the morning and evening distinction, and also quite clear he's talking about how he is shaping the earth and preparing it for the benefit of human beings. Question back here. Could be, may not be. Okay, there's one other place you can go for Creation Day 1, and that's verse 19 and following. What is the way to the abode of light? Where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you're already born. You have lived so many years. And the whole point he's making, he can't even figure out what darkness is all about, let alone the light. So, and you know, I put a little note in the margin here that we have yet to identify exotic dark matter particles. So, that, if you listen to our creation update this Tuesday, we're bringing on a particle physicist, Mike Strauss, who's actually going to talk about a new discovery around black holes where they think they may have actually picked up an exotic dark mass particle. But hey, this is what, 3,500 years after this text was written. And even then, we can't quite be sure, but this could be a really remarkable breakthrough. And the particle they think they've discovered is called an axion, and it may indeed be the most dominant exotic dark matter particle in the universe. Okay, where is the way to the abode of light? Where does darkness reside? God has separated light from darkness, as we see in Genesis 1, verse 3, and we can't even figure that out at this point. Okay. I was going to jump into, well, let me do that. In terms of Creation Day 2, Creation Day 1 is verses 4 to 9, 12 to 14, and then 19 to 21. Now, for Creation Day 2, it's verses 4 to 9, the same four or five verses there, six verses, deal with Creation Day 2, deal with Creation Day 1. verses 22 to 30 and 34 to 38. And actually, you could argue a lot of what we studied in Job 36 and 37 also pertains to creation day too. You can get the audio tapes of those messages and see how that refers to the water cycle that God had set up. But 4, 9, 22 to 30 and 34 to 38. But it is 12 noon, so I'm going to switch gears right now and talk about these discoveries I was going to mention a little bit before. Okay. What's quite exciting is that astronomers have come up with several new ways to measure dark energy. And just to put you up to date, the universe has three predominant components, actually four components. Well, I'll just mention three. Okay, there's a matter that all of us are used to, which is matter made up of protons and neutrons. So all of us here, this room, this church, planet Earth, the sun, the stars, the galaxies, what we're looking at is stuff made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And astronomers refer to that as baryonic matter, baryon being a catch-all term that includes these massive particles that strongly interact with light. That makes up only 4.5% of the density of the universe. So the stuff we think is really important is actually the least significant component of the universe. Okay, 23% of the universe is made up of what I was referring to earlier, exotic dark matter. These are particles that have mass but do not interact well with light. And so you look out at the universe and all you see is darkness. We can tell there's mass there, but it's dark. They call it dark matter. And by the way, there's some point of confusion here. Some of the stuff made up of protons and neutrons is also dark matter. For example, if you've got some distant planet dissociated from a star, it's not going to give enough light for you to see it. But we can tell there's mass there by the gravitational pull of that object. So that would be dark matter. But this is exotic dark matter, stuff made up like of neutrinos and axions, and there's several other possible candidates. So it looks like axions and neutrinos are the predominant component of this exotic dark matter. It's 23% of the universe. But by far the predominant component of the universe is something they call dark energy. 73% of the universe is dark energy. And you've heard me speak about this before. Dark energy has probably been the most significant discovery made by scientists to establish that the universe must have been created by a supernatural designer, a being beyond matter, energy, space, and time. And the reason that's been concluded is that scientists now recognize that the quantity of dark energy in the universe must be fine-tuned to at least one part in 10 to the 120th, or you're never going to get a planet like Earth that could possibly support life. And of anything we know of in science, this is the one place where we can measure the greatest degree of fine-tuning. So that's 120 zeros after the one. And by the way, it's a conservative estimate. There are astronomers in Britain who believe the fine-tuning actually exceeds one part in 10 to the 240th. So it'd be 240 zeros after the one. And this is really putting astronomers in a bind who are not favorable to a Christian interpretation. Because of that many zeros after the one, this is a level of fine-tuning that clearly points to some miraculous input. To put it in some kind of context, the best example that we human beings can manifest in terms of fine-tuning design is about one part in 10 to the 23. So we're seeing considerably more fine-tuning in the engineering design characteristics in this dark energy than we do anything else. Now, because of that, astronomers have been quite eager to put this dark energy to the test, and that's what these new discoveries are all about. 1999 is when astronomers had first nailed down the existence of dark energy, and they did that through looking at distant supernova. If you look at distant supernova, and it's one particular kind of supernova, type 1a supernova, that has the identical brightness no matter where you look at it in the universe. So if you measure the brightness of the supernova, you can tell how far away it is. And if you know how far away it is, and if you know the velocity of that supernova relative to us, then you've got a very accurate measure of the expansion of the universe. And what they noticed was that the universe was expanding in such a way that it showed that the universe's expansion was slowing down for the first 9 billion years of its history, 8.5 billion actually, and speeding up for the last 5.5 billion. And I say 5.5 because these new research discoveries are enabling us